I'm interviewing Stan Weir at his house in San Pedro. Stan, how old were you when you sailed out as a cadet officer? I mean, as a...
We weren't officers, let me tell you.
No, I bet. As a an apprentice cadet.
Well, I was apprentice seaman, and then I was called the cadet midshipman for the Merchant Marine, which would have been Naval Reserve ensign status. I was a beginner. I was, let's see, 1922. I was 20 years old.
And how long was your first trip?
Approximately 7 months.
And where did you sail?
Went through Honolulu, Pearl Harbor, Fiji, Noumea, New Caledonia, the Espiritu Santo, Hebrides, and then shuttled from Espiritu Santo. I was there when the Coolidge sank, and right in front of our eyes, went down, hit our own minefields.
At
Gupa.
At where?
At Espiritu Santo, which is the New Hebrides. It was a joint British-French colony.
And the Coolidge was what? Ship?
It was a big American President Line ship being used as a troop carrier.
And it was sunk by one of our own mines.
And it propelled itself through the minefields. And when the Navy signaled them, you're going to the minefields, the skipper put the screw astern and it backed into two mines. And guys, they were only, 50 to 60 yards from shore, and they were taking their time. Then someone let them know that the water right there was about 1,500 feet deep, and people got off in a hurry, let me tell you.
Did anyone know, were there any fatalities?
We heard no. We were told no, absolutely not, that there weren't any. And it was borne out by the fact that the people who discharged the cargo from our ship in Santo, Espiritu Santo, were on that ship when it sank, mainly black soldiers being used as laborers during the war. But eventually it was used as combat, I'm told. And we shuttled out of Espiritu Santo to other islands in the area, delivering troops, small numbers of troops, 50, 60 troops to this island, to that island, like that, and then back to Noumea, and then to Melbourne, Australia, and Adelaide, Australia. That's when the war was very south part, because the Japanese were so far south. The Japanese were in like northern Australia, on those islands, and then we came back south of New Zealand. We swung the big loop south of New Zealand into the whistling 50s and the roaring 60s with albatross following us all the way.
What do you mean, albatross? You mean fish?
No, the albatross is an immense bird.
Oh.
And they're out there and they follow you night and day. Mm-hmm. But they won't come across to the northern side of the equator. Matter of fact, they leave here in about 30 latitude. And we came practically to the coast of Chile and then came north. And our first port was San Pedro and then San Francisco.
What was the name of the ship you were on?
The Hinton R. Helper.
And at this time, did you travel in convoys?
We went in convoy from somewhere about a day out beyond San Clemente Island here, with a convoy of about 6-7 ships only. It was a pathetic convoy. Old ships. Mm-hmm. We had the only new ship in the bunch, I think. And none of us could go more than about 9 knots.
So at this time you're in the Naval Cadet Program. Is that
the U.S. Maritime Cadet Midshipman Program, I believe is the official name of it.
And if you had stayed in this program, you told us before that you resigned from the program after the first trip to become a regular seaman.
I would have gone on to Kings Point after that trip, Long Island. And within 8 months or so, I would have been a third mate with a license as third mate and a commission in the Naval Reserve as ensign.
What would your relationship been to regular seamen? Would you have been? Would it have been almost as if you were management?
Yeah, absolutely.
Management versus
The 8-12 watch is the third mate's watch. He's the officer on that watch, and he eats in the officer's mess. And the men who stand his watch eat in the crew mess. That's the big line where you eat.
Mm-hmm. What were your duties on ship on this first trip?
Well, ostensibly, my duties were to hang out with the officers constantly and learn the duties of an officer, including navigation and cargo, overseeing cargo movement, and generally, being part of the officer caste, which governs the ship. Instead, after about the first month, I was working on deck daily, all day long, with the bosun and sometimes the carpenter as an additional daytime deckhand. The skipper on the ship was very fearful of the crew, and when he saw that I had switched roles on the ship, he didn't like it, but he never said a word. And when I gave him my resignation, 90 days before the end of the voyage, or whatever the period was that the Naval Reserve law called for, he made no objection and wouldn't even talk. He simply signed it for me, my copy, and gave it back to me, and that was the end of that.
So your decision to spend time on deck and working and spending time with the crewmen was your decision. You weren't appointed to
No, it was totally. And it didn't happen just boom like that with a snap of a finger. It happened gradually over a month period, let's say. It began, like I said last time on tape, Frank McNear, the other cadet who was with me, we're both deck cadets. We walked out on deck with our midshipman's uniform, khaki uniforms on, with the quarter-inch gold braid on the hat and so on, onto the boat deck. And the deck crew was standing on the offshore side, just forward of the midship house, and in view, and we were in view of one another, and they looked up and saw us, and they didn't. It wasn't as if they collectively decided to jeer or anything like that, but you could see the expression on their faces, and it was very obvious what they were thinking, that we were inconsequential and something that was useless on that ship, and I couldn't stand that, and I knew what that meant, and I knew they were my people. That's where I'd been all my life. So I guess it was the bosun who really did it. But he began to lecture me on what had happened in 1934 and where was I. And he gradually made me acceptable to himself and others by the work I was doing and what he was teaching me. But then all the ABs began to teach me things. They would compete to get to show me a new splice, wire splice, things like that.
Did anybody, any of the other officers or anyone else reproach you about you shouldn't be hanging out with these guys?
Well, the third mate, whose name was Frank as well, and was a graduate of the California Maritime Academy. And he was my age. And he encouraged me. He wasn't really comfortable at all with his newfound authority as a third mate in an ensign ship. There was none of the naval stuff. Just being a third mate was really it for him, and he encouraged me to go with those guys.
As a cadet, what were your living quarters like compared to, say?
There were two of us, the two cadets, in a room about 8 by 10, two little desks and bunks.
How did that compare with the deckhands?
Three in the same.
Yeah,
well, a little bit bigger, but not much, and three bunks in a forecastle. Really, it's not a forecastle unless it's in the forecastle head, but tradition still calls where you sleep the forecastle on these ships in this period. I'd forgotten what I was going to... Oh! The Dane, who was the second mate, he had been some kind of radical, I know. And whereas he had become a company stiff, he still had nostalgia about his youth. And he gave me a strange form of encouragement, but the fact was, on that ship, what made it so different was that the chief mate, first mate, who had the 8 to 12, had the 48 watch, had been a first mate on a Matson ship in the Caribbean that had taken a torpedo but hadn't sunk, and a captain had gotten in a naval craft to go off and report the damage at some Caribbean island, leaving this chief mate in charge. And he had been, by his own description, a son of a bitch as a bucko chief mate. And he knew weather. God, he was a meteorologist, a magnificent one, by eyeball and scent. And he saw that ship was going to be right in the eye of a hurricane. And he moved that ship with a hole in her side about 5 or 6 miles, nautical miles, to the lee of this island and saved the ship. But Matson told him that he would, as long as he lived, never be a captain anywhere for them or anybody else, because he hadn't followed orders not to move that ship. Because if salvage had been involved, it might have been that the salvage would have gone to whoever took a line from them, provided he had gotten in trouble in moving the ship.
So that's in the largest...
On the Pacific coast.
Largest operation on the Pacific
coast. On the Pacific coast. It was the part of the Castle and Cook, Big Three, in the Hawaiian Islands. Matson was known as the place where they sent all their dumb sons, and CNH and all these other things are where the really big timers were. But he knew, he's over 60 years old, he's in the twilight zone, this chief mate. And he knew he'd never make skipper. And he had turned anti-company. And he gave the okay to that crew to take me over. He never said a word to me. He didn't make it a conspiracy in which I was involved. He just did the job for me and stood back. And I really appreciated that. I have appreciated it ever since. You learn something.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you spend time when you're working on deck with the crew, and what about when you're when you weren't working on your own time? What sort of activities did you do on ship?
Sit around and play poker and tell lies. Talk about women and ships.
What union were these?
These guys, all the deckhands were Sailors Union of the Pacific, man.
What other union?
The Black Gang, the engine room people were all Marine Firemen, Oiler, Water Tenders, and Wipers Union. And the Stewards Department were all Marine Cooks and Stewards Union. The officers, the deck officers, were all masters, mates, and pilots. And the engine room officers were all in the Marine Engineers Beneficial Association. The radio operator was in the Radio Operators of America, I guess. And there was a purser. And I don't think he was in the union at all, although he should have been.
Sailors.
He was in the Marine Cooks and Stewards and Pursers.
Purser?
Yeah.
These sailors, now, they told you about the 1934 strike and the kind of the tradition of unionism. Did they see themselves as radicals, can you say?
Not in the sense of the radicals who belong to Marxist groupings and so on. They talked about 1934 as if it was their revolution. They never used the term, ever. They didn't see it as a social revolution for all of society so much as they saw it as a revolution for their occupation.
Is that when the SUP came out of the 1934 strike?
Well, the SUP was already in existence since 1885 and had affiliated with the ISU, the International Seamen's Union, which was a worthless... No, Andrew Ferruza came out of the Sailors Union of the Pacific. He was one of the organizers of it. And he was affiliated with the Sailors Union all the time. He was fighting for legislation that would improve the citizenship of seamen. When you sign on the articles of a ship, you lose about half your citizenship. You become a citizen of that ship under that company name. The skipper is the dictator when the ship leaves the dock. And he fought and did get some protection through legislation, through appealing to many congressmen. But the Sailors Union Pacific, in about 1932, like all the other offshore unions and longshoremen, you began to hear things on various waterfronts. In San Francisco, they heard about this guy, Harry Lundberg, in Seattle, who was kind of a wobbly and was leading a lot of job actions and was a lot of courage and a good fighter, good with his fists and young man, a lot of courage. And somehow, they got him down to San Francisco from Seattle to lead the fight against Feruzeth and the bunch from the ISU. As a matter of fact, the story is a famous one among Sailors Union men. The night that they voted to start to be participants in the strike, 34 strike, by supporting the longshoremen and beginning to move for their own hiring hall, just they wouldn't supply any seamen to any company unless came out of their hiring hall. Feruzeth was pleading with the rank and file for a more conservative stance, that they were going too far. He was voted down, and he left the podium and the meeting weeping.
How were, before the sailors got control of the hiring hall, how had they been hired on?
Through the Fink Hall. It was known as the Fink Hall. What was a an employer's hiring hall in which you had a blue book And at the end of every voyage, you got graded. If your continuous discharge or Fink Blue Book didn't have VG, very good, in this little box for how did this seaman comport himself, you were then blackballed out of the Fink Hall and couldn't get a job. Now, in San Pedro, Wilmington was a little different in that the Wobbly still had some strength from the 19... just prior to World War One and after. Even though they lost the strike in Pedro in 1923, a big strike, there was still some strength here, and they had the ability to get people aboard ships even after a couple of bad gradings where you just got G instead of EG. Then you'd be really, you know, made unemployable.
That's interesting, because the longshoremen had the Blue Book idea.
Yes, yeah, their version of, because they were the same employers.
Mm-hmm. This was your first real contact with union people, then.
The first. An Olerite talked to me about the second ship I was on. No, the third. Oliver Pillsworth. He was a follower of Hugo Oler. That was a Trotskyist sect. He was an ultra-left guy. But when he went to Spain, he had a revolution in front of him, and his stuff went there. That is, we had some authority and credibility there. But this Oliver Pillsworth was one of the most conservative people personally I've ever known. He was immaculate in every way, in cleanliness, and he was maker of model ships that were perfect replicas of barkentines and three-masted schooners and all this business. And he said to me, smoking his pipe and carving on this ship, this model ship he was making with his knife, he said, well, the CP has sold out the working class. And I couldn't for the life of me figure out what that meant. How do you sell out the work? I never heard of the working class, just working people. And I'd never been exposed to ideas of that sort. And I kind of stayed away from him. He kind of bored me. What is this crap this guy's talking about? And I wound up being friends with him. I would see him on ashore constantly, and friends of his, and he was a good guy. But at that time, I felt alienated by his use of vocabulary that was foreign to me.
That was on your third voyage?
Something like that.
And go on about this guy. You didn't really bond with this guy as far as your political...
No. And he wasn't the type of guy who could really do that kind of job.
Did he have a political party himself?
He had the sect, the Olerites, while it existed. But by this time, it was gone.
And Olerites were affiliated with the...
O-E-H-L-E-R. They were affiliated with themselves.
With themselves. What was it strictly?
But they had been originally, you know, part of the old Communist League of America.
Uh-huh. Were the Olerites sailors in particular?
No. They were, matter of fact, Olerites, most of them were in unions and had working, you know, and were militant union people. There were never more at any one time than 50 of them.
When you were on ship, did you have union meetings on ship?
There were meetings regularly called by the ship's delegates, departmental delegates. There was a union delegate for the deck gang, one for the black gang, and one for the mess department. And they were not held ever, in my experience, like once a month or every 2 weeks. They were held immediately that any big problem arose. Let's say that the chief mate has let it be known he's going to challenge all the overtime that we've worked on the trip. The meeting be called and held right away to discuss that. Very often, they were all there together anyway after chow at night, except for the men on watch, and they would just constitute themselves a meeting and then make sure that the men on watch knew what had transpired and their opinions obtained before taking any action.
At any time that you're on a ship, were there any crises that, were there any work actions by sailors, slow work, slow down?
Drink, oh, yeah, sure.
What would you, how would they manifest themselves, or what?
Well, I was on a lumber schooner, the Astoria, steam schooner. And we were in Empire, in Coos Bay, a small town. There's a mill there. A mill, a gin mill, a bar, a public phone, a gas station, and a street light. That was Empire with that big mill, that lumber mill. And something was going in the mill, something was a slowdown, something was wrong in the mill. We weren't getting lumber. And as deckhands, we worked the lumber onto the ship. We were the traveling longshoremen. It's a carryover from canvas days when steam schooners were no steam, just lumber schooners. We had a chief mate who was not a lumber schooner man. And he didn't know tradition. And so here we are with no lumber to work. And he came and told us to go over the side, rig swing stages, and paint and chip rust and paint the ship. And no one even, there was no meeting held at all. Everybody just walked off the ship down the gangplank and to the local gin mill, and we stayed there until he came and begged us to return, that it was his mistake, that he didn't know tradition, and he was told by one of the friction winch drivers that we would come back after lunch when we got ready. And there'd better not ever be any sound from him like that again. I led probably 3 to 4 times, I've forgotten which, where I would go on a ship and I would be elected delegate, let's say. And we'd have you want to try this guy? I'll state this a little bit differently. I was probably personally involved in several job actions during the war. Typically the following. I was on a Luckenbach ship. Instead of having springs for the... This is a Luckenbach ship. I've forgotten which one of the Luckenbachs. She was made in Japan in the 20s. Had square portholes. She had chicken wire nailed on the 2x2s for the bunks instead of real springs. And the mattresses were Dundee in the 30s. I mean, and they were loaded with bugs. And we had told them from the first day, you know, get us some decent things to sleep on. And finally, we took direct action and went on the dock. We were to shift ship from Brooklyn to Manhattan. And when it came time to shift and the tugs were all there, we walked ashore and stood there on the dock, ready to come right back aboard the minute they agreed to. And the skipper came out screaming, and we told him, and he promised to get them, and we said, you come down and make the phone call to the company within our earshot, and then we'll come back aboard, which he did. And we got the mattresses and so on. Then, too, a lot of the stewards were trying to make names for themselves on the food, and they'd come back in port with a lot of good food that they could have given us during the trip, and they're short rationing us. And so if they started that, we hit the dock right at sailing time, and the storerooms would come open, and we would have this ice cream that the guy was going to come back into San Francisco with, or fresh oranges.
Why?
Making a name for himself.
For coming in, for not spending much money?
Yes. Showing the company that he could sail short rationed and still come back in without having had general mutiny.